50 years ago, on New Year's Day, Fidel Castro declared victory from the balcony of the Santiago de Cuba's City Hall. That's one day after dictator Fulgencio Batista fled the country aboard a small plane and headed for the Dominican Republic and exile. Half a century later, Fidel is not expected to participate in the celebrations in Cuba's second largest city. He hasn't been seen in public for more than 2 years. Later today, his brother, President Raul Castro, will preside over scaled-down ceremonies. In a moment, we'll talk with two people who were in Cuba 50 years ago, and if you were there too, we'd like to hear from you. Or if you grew up hearing stories about the day the world changed in Cuba, give us a call. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And we begin with Luis Rumbo, who was 10 years old at the time. He joins us today here in Studio 3A. Luis, thanks very much for being with us.
Actually, I was 9, Neil.
9?
Yes, I think I was 10 when I left later.
Well, that was later. What were you doing on that morning on January 1st, 1959?
Well, I'll tell you. First, remember, this is an era before gadgets, before kids had a lot of stuff to play with, MP3s and so on. So I tended to follow the news and read, listen. I was a curious kid. Even at that age, I could tell there was a lot of something strange going on. There was instability throughout the country. I asked my dad, what are these 26... these numbers, 26 in a circle that you see painted around. He dodged the question. That was, of course, the 26th of July movement.
Which was the name of Fidel Castro's movement.
Fidel Castro's movement. There were stories you could overhear the adults telling about people shot or captured or disappeared, and sometimes they came close. And I remember my dad in the backyard at night, in the dark, with a small portable radio, which I'm sure was a shortwave radio, so he could catch Radio Rebelde, which was broadcasting from way on the other side of the island.
You were in Havana.
In the mountains. We were in Havana.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually got traded in for a better desktop model, which the parents kept next to their bed. And this gets to the story, because on that morning on January 1st, we were awakened early to find really a celebration going on in the parents' room. We were jumping up and down in the bed celebrating with them. I had no idea the scope of what was going on, and I doubt anyone at that time could have foretold 50 years later we'd be here talking about it on NPR.
Oh, and there was no NPR at the time either, so.
Right. The parents were Christian Democrats, and they were opposed to the dictatorship, as were many, many, many people. So that was my first experience of the change. The mood had lifted, that instability and that cloud of dread that hung over the country had lifted. A week later, on January 8th, Fidel comes with his column to Havana. The column had crossed most of the island from Oriente way at the east side all the way to the capital, and people had been following the progress of the column. So by the time he gets to Havana...
Column of soldiers, yeah.
Yes. So by the time he gets to Havana, it was like waiting for the Beatles to come across from the ocean. And there was a huge turnout to greet him. We went out there.
You were at 9 years old. Your parents let you go?
Yes. Well, there was 5 of us kids at the time. And I think all of us, the whole group went there. It was kind of crazy. Kids don't handle crowds too well. And I remember trying to figure out which one was Fidel, because I think there were 3 cars, you know, for security, and you could not really tell where he was, but it was enough for people to know that in one of those 3 cars, that was Fidel. My little brother had a Barbudo doll. The Barbudos were the bearded ones, the rebels. And there was an immediate production of the little dolls in army fatigues and beards and rifle and a backpack and so on. And the kids were really into that. That's to convey a sense of what at that time was a tremendously popular uprising. It just had a huge base of support.
We're talking with people who were in Cuba 50 years ago today. If you were too, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now on the phone from his son's home in Miami is George Volsky. He's a former journalist who covered the Cuban Revolution. George, thanks very much for joining us today, and Happy New Year's to you.
Yes, I was in Havana at that time, and the downfall of the Batista regime was not that unexpected. We, having been in the war before, I was in the RAF during World War II, so I knew what the war was all about, and I knew that the demise of Batista government was inexorable. The military men didn't fight. We could see that all the so-called columns of rebels were progressing from the east to west, and it was a question of time. Could be one day, 2 days, or at least a week, but the regime was disintegrating. So didn't catch me by surprise, and I was fairly well connected with the American and the Cuban communities, and I knew what was going on. But I would say that the demonstrations were very, I would say, benign and very joyous. There was no joy more than revenge, even though the Batista regime was, I would say, hated. Knowing from history the upheaval in 1933 when another dictator was expelled, Machado, then was much more bloodshed. That time wasn't. Why? Because we knew that, I knew that some of the families of the principal leaders of the officials of the Batista regime were already leaving. So, again, I say it didn't surprise me that this would happen.
Mm-hmm. We did hear about some of the casinos being wrecked.
Well, slightly, but actually, ironically, the only destruction that happened were the parking meters, because for some reason Cubans' parking was free all over the country, and Havana certainly too. And people regarded that installation of parking meters with some American mafia connections and the Batista regime connections as an infringement of their freedom to park the car. So all the parking meters were destroyed, but the destruction was minimal. Why? Because there were a lot of 26th of July, which our younger friend referred to, on the streets, and they said, no, don't touch anything. This is people's property. So the destruction was, knowing something of history about revolutions, it was, I would say, a joyful upheaval. And, of course, everyone was waiting for Castro to arrive. He was very slowly moving from east to west, establishing his ascendance, his political power in each big town, a provincial town. He would install his city, and then, of course, even the government was being organized, while at the same time in the main base of the military power in Havana, Colombia military base, there was a sort of provisional government which was waiting for Castro to arrive to give him the reins of power, certainly over the police. And policemen disappeared, so on the streets you would see the 26th of July militia type of individuals who kept peace, and as I recall, the destruction was minimal.
Let's get a caller on the line. By the way, we're talking with George Volsky and Luis Rumbo, both of whom were in Cuba 50 years ago today when the world turned. Let's talk with Iona. Iona with us from Mankato, Minnesota.
Hello. Yes, I was there on a Christmas vacation with my family 50 years ago. I was 7 years old, I think, and we had to leave the country. We flew in sub-Cuban airline, I believe, and it was kind of humiliating. All the women were sent to one room and the men in another and stripped down to the underwear. My mother had leopard underwear on, and the women checking us to see if we had money got a kick out of her underwear, and I was traumatized for life from the whole experience. But Cuba was such a beautiful place. We'd go quite often for vacation. My dad was an airline pilot, and I didn't really understand. I've called all my siblings today to say, what was that all about? I didn't realize how momentous it was at the time.
And you just got swept up in it. And where did you fly to?
Miami, I believe.
Right. And with a lot of other people, too. A lot of Americans left that day or shortly thereafter.
Right, and I guess they were checking to see if we were taking money out or something.
Mm-hmm. Anna, we're glad you made it.
Yeah, thanks. Good show. Thank you for all you do. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Let me ask you...
interesting episode, which I now recall. I was a member of one of the prime clubs in Havana, the Biltmoriat Club, and there was one member of the club who had a huge yacht, I think about 160 feet, and he was a minister of the Batista. And one day in December, their yacht left, replete with all kinds of household goods and even some doors, decorative doors. So as a friend of mine, I said, well, that's what it is. They're going away. They're fleeing with their... Lares, the Romans say, Lares et Penates.
Yes.
So that was the end of it. So, in other words, what I'm saying, I want to say that it didn't surprise me very much. It was just a question of days. Most people, of course, were surprised because maybe they didn't realize the degree of decomposition of the Batista regime, especially the army, which didn't fight. In fact, I think one of the latest episodes was that a train, military train, was sent from Havana toward Matanzas province, and it was derailed. And some people say it was sold to the rebels, and that was it. There was no opposition, even though the rebels all over the country had not more than about 1,200 to 1,500 people. But simply the Batista regime was so corrupted, and the army was so demoralized, they didn't offer any
resistance.
And that's why the demise was inevitable.
We're talking about the day the revolution triumphed in Cuba 50 years ago today. Our guests are Luis Rumbo and George Volsky. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Luis, let me ask you, 9 years old at the time, how long was it before you went back to school, and how was that different?
Oh, school continued. There was no change, but it was indeed very different. One of the first things was very unusual for us. They put Fidel giving one of his speeches on this clock box.
PA system.
So all the students, this is a big school, it was grade school and high school combined. And we all heard his speech, and I remember one particular part, he was complaining about what it was like to be an underdeveloped country. And he said in a very insulted tone of voice, even our baseballs are imported. As if he had been saying, even our rum is important. And like baseballs were like essential to the Cuban character. That stuck with me. It stuck with me also that I got to hear very, very early on one of Fidel's speeches, of which I understood just a little bit. Not long after that, the school had, in support of the agrarian reform, which is the first big reform, had sponsored a fundraiser, and we bought a little tractor for agrarian reform. Most of the people there, I'm sure, are now in Miami or some other place in the United States. But at the time, it was that kind of atmosphere that even, this is also a Catholic school, so even the priests in the Catholic school were proudly buying this tractor for the agrarian reform.
Mm. Let's talk with Cynthia. Cynthia's on the phone with us from Vernon in New York.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I want to tell you that I was there on my honeymoon, 29 years old, and I'd like to say that I was young and innocent and didn't know a thing about any world politics. And now I'm 79 and older, and I'd like to share just four sentences with you, okay?
Go ahead.
I am a truthful man from the land of the palm trees, and before dying, I want to share my dreams, these poems of my soul. You know the poet?
That's Jose Martí.
Jose Martí, Guantanamo. I believe when I was young, I'm not blaming myself. I didn't know much, but I think we're all brothers and sisters around the world. And I'm 79 now. We're all in the same boat. We need to talk to each other. We're one family on the only people planet. So God bless all you young folks. I hope that you learn to live in peace. Thank you.
And Cynthia, just briefly, tell us what you did that New Year's Eve.
No, I'm honest. I'm an honest person, Neil. So I'll confess nationwide to your million, what do you call it, million listeners. The only way I could get on here is to tell a little fib. I have never been in Cuba. But I wanted to give that message to you, and I apologize for lying.
Well,
okay?
All right, Cynthia.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's move on. We just have a minute left. I wanted to go back to George Volsky in Miami. You were there as somebody who was covering this. We just have a minute left. What were you doing in the days immediately after January 1st?
Trying to assess how the power is going to be, how power is going to develop, because obviously the dynamics of the revolution is something that an observer, a journalistic observer, has to take into account. So obviously there was a struggle between different elements in the Castro regime and especially the people who were 26th of July, who were people who were in the cities. So that was developing. That was something that we have to watch and see who is going to be on top. Of course, Castro was, but that was just the beginning, and we simply didn't know how this would turn. But in any event, the first, say, couple of weeks were weeks of joy and of relief that a nightmare is gone, but at the same time, an unknown looking to the future. So, being an older person and with some experience, I knew that it wouldn't be all joy. There's some bad things going to happen. How quickly? This is something we didn't know, but certainly I had my eyes open. Incidentally,
George, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
George Volsky, a journalist who was in Havana during the revolution, with us by phone from Miami. Our thanks, too, to Luis Rumbau, who was 9 years old on this day 50 years ago when the revolution happened in Havana in Cuba. Thanks very much. This is NPR News.